Hey, all you podcast listeners. Today, Marcus interviews Kelly Bonner, a gender equality and victims' rights advocate, corporate wellness trainer, and expert on burnout. She has had an absolutely fascinating and amazing career, and through learning from her own personal experiences and struggles, has created a company called Burn Bright. Burn Bright is focused on helping high-achieving, hard-working, creative women with burnout. This is definitely something the world needs. Kelly is an engaging speaker, and I really enjoyed listening to her. I could have actually listened for hours. She's a perfect example of an empowered woman helping out other women. I'm so inspired by her work and her story. I hope you enjoy this podcast too. Our music was written and performed by She, spelled SH3, and produced by Android Beats. Check them out on our website. This podcast is sponsored by Femme Apparel. We believe in gender equality and use thought-provoking messaging to bring attention to gender disparity and to challenge the status quo to be more inclusive and equal. And with that, I'll hand you over to Marcus.
Morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. I'm going to put my headphones on just in case if it sounds better. Does it sound okay to you without it?
Yeah, you sound great.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Do I sound okay?
Yes, you sound fine to me.
Perfect.
How are you, Marcus?
I'm very well. How are you, Kelly?
Pretty good.
Nice to kind of sort of meet you.
I know, right? In this world, I think this is as good as it's getting right now.
I know. This is pretty normal these days, I think.
I know, unfortunately.
Where are you located?
Canada, right?
Pardon me?
You're in Canada, right?
Correct, yeah.
What part?
In the province of Ontario, way up top in a town called Thunder Bay.
Okay. I'm originally from a place called Plattsburgh, New York, which is right by Montreal, Canada, and by Cornwall, a little close-ish to Cornwall.
Oh, yeah, okay. I know those. I've been to Montreal many times. And where are you now?
I'm now in D.C., Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. Nice.
But Montreal is probably from Plattsburgh, under 60 minutes probably to get there.
Oh, nice.
It's actually closer than some of the American cities. So I used to go up there all the time. Just for some culture.
Okay.
Plattsburgh is not a bastion of culture. So,
yeah, so Montreal is probably one of our most cultural cities. So
it's like it's night and day. You go from like rednecks and very backwoods hick country to it's multicultural, multilingual city that is like old Montreal. So I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, very European.
Yes. My mom is European. So it was like, my mom's like, oh, thank God, something that reminds me of home because this isn't it.
How do you find DC? I've only been there once and I just did like the touristy stuff, obviously, but I loved it. I thought it was amazing.
I liked it. I needed a place I had never been before I moved here. I've been here about 2 years and I needed like a soft place to land. I lived in Europe for 5 years before coming back. So I lived in the States and then I went to Europe for 5 years and I came back and I was like, where can I live that won't be the most culture shock possible? And my friend was like, why don't you try DC? There was a job that opened up and I said, okay, if I'm going to come back. And so far I have to say like, it was the best decision, all things considered. Just because it's a city, but it's not really because it's a government city. So like at about, 5 o'clock, it's a ghost town by like 8, 9 o'clock. It's really just very cultural different things. And on the weekends, because it's all politics, it revolves around that. So
yeah.
I liked it. It's okay. Like I'd rather not be in America, frankly. I'd rather live in Europe the rest of my days, but if I had to be back in the States for a bit, in some ways I hate that I'm in DC, in some ways I love it.
Where were you living in Europe?
I lived in London for 2 years in Cambridge, UK, like about 40 minutes outside of London. And then I lived in a place called Sicily, Italy, which is about 50 minutes outside of north of Venice. So I lived on like the Italian Dolomites border, like right in the top of Italy, northern part.
What were you doing there?
So I did a couple things, but one of the things I did is I worked for American government helping Americans with like sexual assault prevention on military bases is what I did in Italy. And then in England, I worked more with like State Department to help them with like medical, I did like medical liaisoning for them to help them get home if they had medical conditions.
Oh, okay. So you were still you're a government employee, like an American government employee.
Yeah.
Overseas. Yeah. Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. That's a good segue to like just get right into it. But why don't you give us a sort of a rundown of your work career and what you specialize in?
Sure. So I tell people my work career has zigzagged all over the place. There has been no straight line as to what I've done. I am a social worker by trade, or a licensed clinical therapist. So my specific background is in trauma. I'm a trauma therapist. So that's what I went to school for, and that's what I specialized in. And I started my career in the prison systems. I started by working in behavioral modification for really supposedly ultra violent inmates, male maximum security men's prison. So that's where I started, which I actually love the work of that. Prison's a whole other story, but working with incarcerated men, loved. Then I worked and did some PTSD work with veterans and had contact with the military in a way that way. And that led me to overseas because I started working with veterans, and then there was an opportunity to go overseas to work in bases, and I always wanted to work overseas. So I bounced around Europe for 5 years and then fell into sexual assault work because I had a background in working in military sexual trauma and women and men who had been sexually assaulted because of my trauma background. So I became like a women's right and gender rights activist and advocate. I did a lot of victim advocacy and also started teaching corporate wellness at the same time that I started teaching about prevention of sexual assault. So I specialized and started loving corporate wellness. So about 5 years ago, zigzagged again into corporate wellness and started picking up and noticing that a lot of women and myself had been burned out but didn't have a clue what that was, and we had a lot of different words for it, like exhausted, depressed, stressed, I hate my job, things like of that nature, but really didn't know the language of burnout. And so when one of my certifications, I was learning about compassion fatigue and burnout along with trauma, and put it kind of all together, all my experiences, and decided I really wanted to do corporate wellness, but really focusing on women now and burnout specifically, like why people lose the ability to do what they love and how to keep them from doing it. And so that's partly what I focus on now, along with some of the other things I've done in the past, is helping women feel empowered to stay doing what they love. Wow. See, zigzag.
Yeah, but it all comes together, right? Like it does mesh. So let's unpack this a little bit. The maximum security prison thing is really interesting to me. So talk a little bit more about that. You said you really enjoyed working with the men in the prison.
Yes.
Yeah, why? Just explain that a little bit, because I don't really understand what kind of work you would be doing with them. So How does rehabilitation look?
Right. So, I mean, part of it is that prison in itself, I think in America, really isn't rehabilitative, right? That's one of the lessons that I learned. It's not set up that way, but, you know, we try to give the illusion that it is. But the program that I worked with, it took people that were misbehaving chronically in a prison environment, so much so that they were removed from the general population, as they called it, put in a special housing unit. Then they were failing out of that, going to behavioral health programs, failing out of that, and then being told, oh, we don't know what to do with you. We're going to throw you over here, and, you know, Kelly is going to fix you with no money. And so they would send them up to me and another person that I worked with. And we did, like, anger management and just emotion regulation in general. But also we did things like poetry and art, and I brought movies in, and we did games and recreational therapy. I ran another program where we did gardening. For me, a lot of it was just about giving people space to be human, and prison does everything but that. It strips away people's humanity. And also there's the racial elements of it that I worked in the largest maximum security prison in New York State. I was the only black employee in that prison, and yet the majority of people in prison we know are of black and brown descent, and the majority of people working in prisons are white. So there's a lot of racial issues in the prison system. And so a lot of trauma in that environment to begin with. So a lot of it was just making space for people to feel human. And so that was rewarding to me, to create that space for a couple hours a day and to let people be human again and to see that. And so that's where the reward came.
Was it ever scary, frightening?
Yes, it was. I think most times, though, surprisingly, I was more frightened of the people I worked with than the people that they were guarding, than the inmates. So there were times that I was scared of the inmates. There were some people there. The majority, I mean, there are some myths about maximum security prison, which is that the majority of people in there are, you know, serial killers and did all these terrible things. In America, specifically, majority of people in maximum security prisons aren't murderers. They're like low level, either drugs or robbery or things of that nature. However, there were some that were serial killers, and those people are truly scary. And so those are frightening. But a lot of the people and the attitudes were what was scary that I worked with, and their perceptions of the people they worked with made them scary to me. And they had we end up having a lot of tension between us because of who I was and what I was there to do. And that at times made the job scary.
Do you think that the prison system is set up to fail the inmates the way it operates currently?
Absolutely, 100%. It's structured to keep people in. It's structured to keep them as inhumane as possible and not recover and not be better versions of themselves. So it becomes its own revolving door.
Have you heard of the program? I can't remember which one it's out of. It's on the West Coast. I'm not familiar with my big prison names, but they've created this program where you have to be on model behavior. And if you are, they teach you how to program and code. For the computer. And then there's some great examples where guys have come out of this program and been hired by Facebook or hired by Google. And they're trying to roll this out across more prisons in the United States. And it just seems like such a no-brainer. I don't really understand what prison life is like, but I'm going to have to imagine that they probably don't afford the inmates the ability to really get skills to integrate into society when they're done their sentence. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, again, I've been out of the prison system for a bit, so I don't think coding was an option when I was working. Mm-hmm. It's been about 10 years since I worked in a prison, but yeah, a lot of the skills that they were teaching people are not skills that they'll ever get paid for. I mean, they did teach paralegal skills, and you don't have to, that's something you can do with a criminal record, excuse me. But most of the time, there's so many things facing people beyond that, that even if you are highly skilled, if you're a person of color and you have a record, you're less likely to get hired no matter how genius you are at whatever you do. And some of the skills that we're teaching people are not skills that they are going to want to do outside. Like coding is something that people would want to do and is highly marketable. There wasn't that kind of thoughtfulness put into what we're teaching inmates. It's more like, let's pass the time. And then there's the prison industrial complex where it's like, we now can just get inmates to make cheap goods for us on the outside. So it's really less about them acquiring skill and more about a really nice desk we can make and charge $300 for that we made in a prison for, you know, $2.
Right. Interesting. So how did you then transition from prison work to military work?
The skills were the same. Like I did a lot of some trauma work. Prison really isn't the safest place to do trauma and pack trauma for people, but the skills of mental health are the same. And so I wanted to look into where I could do more trauma work and where I thought I could get more freedom and there'd be more kind of less controversy, I thought, in a population like the veteran population. And so I kind of transitioned to that. I saw some opportunities and I had a friend tell me, why don't you think about working with veterans? And I loved, again, working with them. It was predominantly men who had been in the Iraqi and Afghanistan conflicts, young guys around my age now, in their 20s at the time, because I was in my 20s, who had come back with traumatic brain injuries and PTSD from combat and were just like again, existentially conflicted, like inside of themselves, like what was my purpose? They kind of were like, I'm not sure what I did over there. They saw things that they couldn't kind of unsee. And that again was a joyous, I did group work with them as well. And that was kind of a joyous time as well, as far as clinical work.
Is it ever overwhelming for you as the clinician working with people that have experienced what probably is really horrific situations?
Yes. I mean, that's part of what led me down to what I do now and why I love working with helping professionals, is that I think that we as therapists are trained, and nurses as well, and educators, people are kind of on the front lines. We are trained on how to be great for other people, but we're really poorly trained on how to be good to ourselves. And how, because what we do is we sit in the presence of people's pain all day long. If you're a nurse, that's what you do, right? For the most part. If you're a therapist, that's what you do. And so it was overwhelming many times, because you would hear people say horrible things that they say for you, right? They're not going to tell their parent or their partner or their relative that. It's either their deepest shame of something they've seen, or just something that's so horrible they know better, and they just say that at the dinner table, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to save that for a safe space. Mm-hmm. And so many times it was, you would just have to figure out ways, and I had to learn ways, sometimes not great ones, then later better ways to cope with that, holding that space for someone and learning how to get rid of that almost immediately.
That's interesting. Why do you think that there's not focus on, it's like training the trainer almost, like, right? Why is there not that emphasis? Because I've always wondered this too, like when you're helping somebody deal with such intense trauma, be it physical or mental, emotional, you're absorbing it too, I would imagine. Right. And so I'm surprised that there's not more conversation around that for the frontline workers to help deal with that situation.
I think we've come further now than we ever have. But I think when I got into this, and it's been about 15 years, and even now I still hear people tell me that, I think it's because people, there's just an absence of knowledge. Like, there's so much time and energy put on being good at your skill set that nobody bothers to talk about the consequences of being actually good at your job, right? And that happens just across the board in any job, really, when you think about it. Like, nobody talks about the consequence, which is why burnout's an epidemic. It's not just for frontline workers, but across the board. What are the consequences of being really good at your job, being a really good architect, or being a really good, you know, interior designer? No matter what it is, there's a consequence to being really proficient if you're not good at certain other skills, which are self-care skills and mindfulness. But particularly in the frontline worker fields, it's really kind of bizarre that we never had that embedded in the curriculum. And I don't know if it's this kind of false sense of like martyrdom in our field, where it's like, you just give because that's the right thing to do. And that's, you know, what our heroes do, right? Like, frontline workers are also kind of seen as heroes. And when you think of the mythology of a hero, they are the selfless person to a fault, right? Like, you never see them taking time for them. When we think of our heroes, they give themselves to death, or they do the noble sacrifice. And I wonder if some of that mythology didn't like eke into what we teach people who do kind of frontline work.
Yeah, that's probably a very good point, actually. You assume a certain person might go into it because they're strong enough to do it, and then we just take that at face value.
Yeah, which isn't true. I mean, everybody's like has a finite skill amount of everything, right?
Of course. yeah, you know, I can see that too. Even you brought up a good point about like not just the frontline workers, but anybody in any job, because there's that saying that the person that's good at their job ends up just getting more work put onto them because their manager knows they can do it, and the person who sucks gets a free ride because, well, we're not going to give it to Johnny over here because he's not good at it anyways, right? So we'll give it over here to Sally and she'll get it all done. And so it just perpetuates this cycle of overwhelming tasks, I guess.
Yes. And that's a lot of people who are burnout. Like, I, my target audience is high achievers, because high achievers, regardless of their field, tend to burn out because of that, right? Like, mediocre people don't burn out because nobody trusts them enough with tasks to get there, right? They're like, you're not going to trust. In fact, mediocre people tend to rise up in the ranks because they find somebody who is the Energizer Bunny, right? And they put the tasks on them to keep going and going and going, and they stay mediocre and chill and, you know, profit off of and benefit off of their, you know, their productivity. So absolutely, I think anybody who's good at anything is prone to burnout if they don't understand pacing themselves and being very clear about what their intentions are when they're doing work. And I think like the authenticity piece and being very clear about what you're doing, why you're doing what you're doing, becomes so essential to not burning out.
So define burnout for us, just so the audience knows like exactly when you yeah. use that phrase, what you mean by it.
So I use two definitions for it, and they sync. And the clinical definition, because it has been accepted, like the World Health Organization now recognizes burnout as a clinical illness. Like it's a thing. It's a real thing. Is that it's a physical and emotional exhaustion that is characterized by cynicism and hopelessness, and also can have some somatic symptoms. So you can feel physically ill too, stomach disruption, insomnia, things like that. You know, I tell people like you just side eye permanently or looking at people sideways that have joy in their lives because you don't anymore, because you've lost all of that. I add to that by telling people that I see burnout as like a betrayal of self, that I see burnout as all the little ways that you have left behind what is who you are or what's most important to yourself. And so I see it as more of like a loss of authenticity or a misalignment. So a lot of people who burned out of a job, a relationship, just whatever it is, whatever was most important to them or who they were. So if they entered a job and they said, it was my goal to be compassionate or to be present with people, and then they see themselves losing pieces of that, or it's important to me to be a good partner. That's who I am, as I'm a good partner, but I constantly am staying late for work and missing date night or not home for dinner. And those little betrayals add up and they create this chasm between who they want to be and who they are. And that increases burnout, and that leads to burnout, those little series of betrayals.
So how can people recognize, or what are some of the early signs that people can recognize that they're starting to get towards this burnout stage?
So early signs can be really simple. A lot of it is fatigue. So it usually starts as that you're tired. And you start being isolative. So I see whatever your normal was, because some people are naturally introverted and they don't go as much normally. But if your normal was you were a social person and you were going out, and now you find yourself going out, but you're low energy when you're out, or we're not really going out that much anyways. But if you find yourself with your groups of people or video chatting, but low energy, not positive, feelings of resentment, your sleep is off, you're unable to focus as much on tasks, that's usually the beginning of burnout. A lot of mistakes people make, and it's really important for me to say, is they associate productivity with burnout, and they wait until they're no longer productive to say they're burnout. They're burnt out. They're usually burned out before that, because high achievers will keep going and denying they're in burnout, right? They'll say, but I'm still getting what I need to get done, so I'm good. And it's like, no, you are just on fumes. You're just really good at your job. And they're fatigued. They're not sleeping. They're isolating. It's draining all of their energy to connect with people that used to be effortless to connect with. Those are usually the early warning signs.
And so what should people, if you notice that you're experiencing these, and actually, hold on, let me ask another question first. Is it possible to have like micro burnouts, right, where it can happen, but then it can go, as opposed to like a massive burnout where it's having a large impact on your life?
I think people micro burnout probably, and they probably do series of it before they get to, because again, they associate with productivity, right? Most people only call it burnout when they've hit the wall and are in a puddle and not able to do work, or they are clinically depressed at that point. Let's say they've hit a diagnosis. And they haven't realized all the ways that they were micro burned out or having episodes of burnout before. So yes, and you can kind of pull yourself out of that pretty quickly once you have some kind of foundational concepts under your belt. versus going all the way to hitting the wall. And then you have to do a little, I mean, you can still pull yourself out of it. That's the great thing about burnout. It's a temporary condition, but it takes longer to recover.
So if you're recognizing these signs of burnout, what's your recommendation for what are the first things you should do?
The first thing that I tell people is they do a lot of people who have burnout also think that the mistake they make is they do a lot of self-care, which I'm not opposed to, but the self-care they do actually doesn't fix the problem. So the first thing you need to do is burnout also is a dysregulation of your nervous system. So just to get a little sciencey. So one of the things that happens, So one of the things that happens when you're burned out is you are in a permanent state of hyper arousal. So you're like basically clenched, the tense position, right? You're like that all the time. And you are no longer, when you're like this, right? You're tense. You're no longer able to, your body goes right into fight or flight response. Whether you want it to or not, it's like that. And so your nervous system becomes dysregulated. It's no longer like going through this normal pattern of up and down, relax. And so when it moves into fight or flight response, that's when you lose all higher thinking. Like you cannot think clearly. You lose what people say elegance. You lose the ability to kind of have nuance and beauty and all the other things, which is why people get bitter and resentful and things like that. So the first thing is, you know, I teach people how to regulate their nervous system, how to kind of calm down so that they can receive information better. And you can do it in a number of ways. One of the ways that we tell people is you can do it a longer way is like a guided meditation, body scan, which has you kind of unclench your body. If you've ever done a guided relaxation, by the time you're done, you kind of feel like a wet noodle, right? You feel kind of like loose all over. And that definitely regulates your nervous system. But the problem is when you go back into something, you immediately tense, right? You open an email or you get to a fight with somebody and you're right back where you started. So one of the things I teach people is how to do that in 30 seconds or less so that they are not stuck. And it really is crazy, but it works. And I usually tell people like the best way I tell them is like the metaphor of taking people have a stick up their behind. I tell them to remove it. And the way I tell them to do it is to focus on their pelvis and relaxing it. And there's something about the nerves, the vagal nervous system that connects your body that runs right through there that relaxes your body. It takes you out of that fight or flight response. And so if nothing else, just like to focus on that. There's a couple other poses you can assume too that immediately relaxes your body. So that's step one. And then step two, I walk people through a couple of mindset shifts, but one particular one I tell them is to get really clear on what drives them. And it's a whole like exercise about what's your mission and what do you think your purpose is. But I tell people to focus on just for this interview, like to talk about what are the three things that make you thrive and to really get clear on what those are. So when I think about those three things for myself, it recenters me on focusing on how I can inject that into my workday. So one of my three things is creativity. So if I'm really at burnout or micro burnout, I think about how can I bring creativity into my job in small ways. And so for me, it can be as simple as I love planning. I'm a planner freak and I love stickers. And I have a very serious day job with like C-suite executives. And I will bring my glittery, silly planner with me everywhere with my stickers. And I will open it up in front of the C-suite executives because I don't care. And I will be like, who wants a sticker? One. And two, I will bring that out to showcase whatever we're talking about for organizational strategy, what we're working on. But it's something I need that makes me feel true to myself and makes me feel less likely to burn out because it reminds me of something that sparks joy in my day.
Interesting. And how is that received when you're dealing with executives?
I mean, it's mixed, but I mean, I also don't really care. But it's mixed. I find more people than not have come around to the idea of happiness is kind of contagious. And there is something about people, what I'm good at my job, and most people who are listening to this or watching this are good at their jobs too. They're good, right? So if you can be good and yourself, there's something about that and how that reaches people that is disarming. And the only people left that are hating it, it's obvious to everybody else in the room. It's like, well, you know, you're just a bitter old guy, right? Like, oh, well, you know, because if you're good at what you do, it just becomes a personality quirk or whatever. But it's usually well received. I've given people stickers. They take well to it.
Like, I'd imagine it would be an awesome icebreaker.
It is. They really respond. It's part of me. I mean, it wouldn't work if it was somebody else and it was forced. But because it's who I am, I mean, it's like, okay, it's, you know, it's Kelly. She's going to do the sticker. What? Okay. Let her do her thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, I can even just see here in the Zoom call, you bring so much positive energy that it's just like, why wouldn't there be stickers?
Let there be stickers, people.
There you go. So what was the catalyst for you starting your company? And it's called Let's Burn Bright. Yeah. What was the catalyst for you starting that?
So the catalyst for starting Burn Bright was me thinking about the fact that I knew there were so many people who had similar journeys. So, you know, I started the prison job and I burned out of that job. I completely burned out of that job by 27 years old. Like,
ball flame just completely.
Big time. Like, that's a whole nother podcast where I tell you my epic goodbye speech in that job where, like, I really went full Jerry Maguire minus the, like, flailing of arms and throwing things. If anyone's seen Jerry Maguire when he quits his job, it's fabulous. I did that at my going away, like, had no job lined up. I was like, I'm going to forget all you people. Anyways, went crazy by 27. So, and I knew so many other people had maybe less dramatic, but had similar experiences, and there was nobody who had been kind of teaching how to prevent it or how to recover, because then I just kept going into other jobs, right? And just doing similar-ish, less traumatic, less bigger burnouts, but like micro burnouts. And so that really was impetus for me to, one, once I learned the language of burnout, which like 90% of the world doesn't have, I said, I really want to start helping people stay in jobs they love or find jobs better for them by teaching them what this is and how to get through it. Because it's so easy to recover from once you know what it is.
Cool. Yeah, we're going to do a follow-up. Absolutely, we're going to do a follow-up. And I want to hear that story at some point.
So good. I'm not trying to brag on it, but it is so good because it is so crazy. But so epic that I just was like in my soul, and it involves like one of those cards they gave me that had like a cat, you know, the cat card that's like hang in there.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
What the staff gave me for going away because I had no job lined up. Like, it's so good. And then I just had lost it. And like the cake had got passed out and I was like, that's it. I'm telling everyone how I feel. I quit this job.
So explain to us then exactly what you do with Burn Bright.
So Burn Bright is the combination of a couple of things. I do both in person and in groups, and I'm developing an online course later on this fall. But I walk people through this protocol I've developed based upon clinical skills I've learned. I am certified in burnout and compassion fatigue. And so I walk them through with the group particularly because I do believe, one, you need the skills, but two, you need community. Because I feel for women particularly that there is women have a lot of friends, but they don't have a lot of supports. And they don't have people who will help them be accountable and help them push them forward, whether that be mentor, however you want to language it. But those are the people that really make you get to the next level in life. So that's a huge component, is keeping the group small and developing subgroups even within that to push you forward to reach your goals. But we walk you through the regulating of your nervous system first to get you where you need to be. And then we go through a series of mindset shifts. We introduce the concepts of community and how to find supports at your job, either internally in your sphere or in the group. And we also go through just a series of exercises to kind of get you stabilized within 6 weeks. If you were burned out, you shouldn't be, or you should be well on your way to not being. And if you weren't, but like just stressed, you should have the skills to keep yourself from ever getting there. That's really the goal. And then I do the same thing, but on an individual basis. And then we add a component of self-care. Self-care comes at the end, because if you haven't done the other work, self-care is just like it's great to do.
Would it be fair to say it's like a Band-Aid, but doesn't really deal with the issue?
Everyone loves it, and I recommend it. I mean, who's going to say no to self-care? But, you know, a bubble bath isn't going to stop burnout. I did all that, and you will still epically burn out from a job with all the bubble baths and all the massages and all the happy hours. Like, they're great. Don't not do them, but don't think they'll substitute for.
That's not the root of the problem.
Right. Exactly. So
when you do this work, do you do this with, you had mentioned C-level, like the C-suite, right? Mm-hmm. Employee, but it sounds like you must do a lot of work with, like, what level of organization do you work with? Is it only executives, upper management, middle management, anybody that's willing to sign up?
Basically anyone. I do some of this with obviously C-suite folks, but a lot of that's like organizational risk, because that's where they're focused in on, and it's like I work my magic while I'm doing that. But it's with anyone. I really want to work with women of all levels, people who do direct practice, nurses, teachers, anybody really who sees themselves in this work as prone to burnout. That's really what BurnBright's for. It's not really like a company executive tailored endeavor. That doesn't mean a person couldn't do that if they are, but it's really for anybody who really relates to that story and relates to what I'm saying about this and the messaging. That's who it's for.
Do you find, or do you feel, or is it even maybe proven that women experience either more burnout at work or a different type of burnout at work? And I'm wondering if, because unfortunately we still have, you know, gender roles nowadays, and women in the workplace probably are also dealing with more of the home life compared to their male counterparts. So is there a correlation there with women experiencing different or more types of burnout in the workplace?
Yes. I think women experience burnout by far more than men for a couple of reasons. One, again, if you go just on the clinical diagnosis, they tend to be more exhausted because of dealing with multiple roles. And then if you go off of how I define it as a betrayal, women are forced so often to be half of themselves, to be very not present in their day-to-day lives, whether it's like I have to switch into my job role and then I have to pretend to be something, or I have to entertain sexist jokes in the workplace, or smile at someone being annoying to get ahead, right? Or I have to pretend I'm not a mom at work because that doesn't get far, that won't get me where I need to go. Or I'm balancing roles where I have to sacrifice myself to be a mom or a partner. And there's so much of women who are segmenting and compartmentalizing who they are in a day that accelerates burnout. The less likely you are to align all of your identities, the more likely you are to burn out. And so I think on both levels, women are prone to burnout far more than men, although men do burn out. I don't want to also minimize that. Men are burning out because it's still very difficult, no matter who you are. But I think women particularly are more prone to burnout than men.
Is part of your program an educational piece for male counterparts to understand that dynamic, which they may, in some cases do, but may not necessarily experience on the same level?
Yes. I mean, when I work on a more organizational level, for sure. BurnBright, when I'm doing groups and individual, is just for women. But when I work with organizations and do corporate wellness, a lot of what I do when I do gender advocacy and I do more diversity, equity, and inclusion work is very much so letting men know the ways that they occupy space, and how by the space they occupy, it sometimes comes at an expense for others at times, and for women particularly, and how that can cause burnout, that they don't always exercise the space they hold in the most thoughtful manner or inclusive manner, and that leads to burnout.
Along the same lines of the women question is, do you notice a difference between races? Like, would black people in the workplace be more prone to burnout, you know, compared to their white counterparts or any other sort of minority?
Yes, for sure. I think, again, same thing. I think anytime you can't be yourself, or you have to feel a way to shrink yourself or push back against people who shrink you. Because I think that's part of it. I think what people don't realize is if you're a woman and then you add other intersecting identities. So start if you're a woman and you walk into the workplace, you spend a good chunk of your day or in the beginning of your career being like, okay, don't talk about these things because that makes people uncomfortable and people will make assumptions about you. Don't get pregnant in your first year of work because then people will think, oh, great, she got pregnant this early, right? Don't, you know, use your cycle as an excuse not to come to work because then people will think you're a slacker. There's all these things you have to think about that men don't, right? And then if you add intersecting identities of being a person of color, don't bring up race or be careful about being perceived as being an angry black woman, or if a woman says something, right, they're considered a certain way, and if a man says something, they're not. And so there are all these ways that there are intersecting identities that push you to have to be something other than who you are. And I think that that makes burnout more accelerate. The more you have to pretend, the more likely you are to burn out of a job than somebody else who gets to be themselves at work all day long or not think of those things.
Have you, that makes perfect sense when you say it. I'm sure a lot of people don't think of it though, going through the day to day. And that's part of a greater conversation happening in America right now, of course. Have you seen or do you anticipate seeing with COVID and lockdowns, and here in Canada, for example, in Ontario, schools have been canceled since March. So kids have been homeschooled. And so I'm gonna imagine you're going to see a spike in burnout as parents try to work from home, have their kids home, or trying to homeschool them while they're home. And like, that's a lot of hats and a bunch of them we're not used to wearing, right? And again, I'm gonna assume a lot of it falls on the woman as opposed to the man in the relationship. So are you anticipating a significant spike in burnout cases?
Yeah, for sure. There's gonna be a significant spike in burnout cases and a significant amount of relationship strain too. I think a lot of people are being forced to, they're having this forced work-life integration that they didn't plan. And so because people compartmentalize themselves, all that's being smushed in. So it's like some people are realizing for the first time, I didn't even know you were married, right? until COVID hit. I didn't even know you had children because they've kept their work lives so separate. And now it's like, oh, there's a toddler in the background. I guess that's how we're finding out you may have children. And then having to balance all of that and not that ever being a consideration. And it's an equalizer because even if you had money, right, the nanny is refusing to come because they don't want COVID-19. So they're like, nope, you're on your own. So now you're having to juggle that. And it is very difficult. And then it does fall a lot on gender lines. Like the expectation is that the woman will now take that on. And even if not, sometimes if a man is out of practice, they're willing, but they're like, I just haven't had that practice in that role.
Yeah.
They're not really great at it. So they're struggling or they're like tapping on the door. Like, can you come fix this? The child's crying. I don't know how to make this stop. So I do anticipate there'll be a lot of that. And then you add a lot of like social movements going on for people with intersecting identities, racial identities. And I feel like that is another layer of stress and exhaustion that's hitting people that will continue to accelerate burnout.
What would you recommend for people that are, we'll call it, stuck at home in that situation and dealing with things they've never had to deal with? Like, what, just even just a few ideas on how to help you get yourself through it until we can have a greater conversation about it?
Yeah, because right now it really is just getting through it. And that's part of it, is having that perspective. Is like, now is not the time. I mean, a lot of people are saying, I'm going to do all the things. If you can do that, good for you. But now really isn't the time. Like, now is the time to just get survival mode accomplished. So I really encourage people, for example, families, if you can coordinate a day off where you can just sit and talk with your partner about, what are we going to do? What schedule can we sit down and plan? You know, do a long weekend, you know, where you can plan like a Friday and a Monday. So you can really anchor some time to figure out a schedule of how to make it work, figure out talking some things through, try to keep things as routine as possible. Keep a dinner time where you guys can sit around the table and talk about things. Keep a date night if you had one before, or start one if you haven't. Even if it's like with the kids around, it's like, well, if you have little ones, can we put them to bed? And we can even have date night from like 9 to 10 if they're in bed, right? Where we just watch a movie, and if you fall asleep watching the movie, we got to do something to keep, preserve some sense of normalcy versus fighting to kind of evolve as a couple. Now's our chance. I mean, for some people it might be, I'm not saying it's not, but it's probably not everyone's time to shine. I mean, this is a really crappy time in all of our existence. So let's just focus on getting through it intact and really putting, shoring up some routines that we have, or building some, you know, then going for gold of like the highest standard of parental care. Like, let's not make this a time we're going to be parents of the year. Let's just get through dinner time and have some normalcy to instill for our kids so they don't see like the world is crumbling around them, versus being parent of the year and then burning out 4 weeks into that, because it's not sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that social media has played a part in burnout? Because like, you look at the Instagram world and it's like perfect. Everything's perfect. You look at Pinterest, everything's perfect. And it sets, I would imagine, an unreasonable expectation.
Yes, the lies, the amount of lying going on social media. And particularly, like, women are doing a lot of it too. Like, guys do too. Everybody's lying on social media. And it's just like, there's no need to. And that's what I'm seeing a lot of. It's like, I'm spiritually growing this year in 2020 amidst COVID. It's like, oh, okay. You spiritually grow. The rest of us are white knuckling it. And we need to stop lying about how much spiritual growth is happening. If you are a millionaire and you can afford to go like plastic free and, you know, vegan and do yoga for 3 hours every day during COVID, absolutely do that. Like, I'm not knocking that as a good way to live your life. For the rest of us who are just like happy to exist and feed somebody else beside ourselves, that should be a reward enough too. And if you happen to gain 10 pounds during COVID, that's okay as well, because everybody's stress eating, you know? So really, social media, turn it off. And when you see people peddling this stuff, some of them are authentic and they're really doing it, but unpack the privilege that allows them to do that. Most of them are living on a beach house. Like, I watch some of the Instagram people, no disrespect to them, but they're like, oh, COVID's allowed me to rent a house in the hills and I don't see people for 3 miles. Well, that's nice. I have neighbors above me who are coughing right now. I'm not happy. I don't know if they have COVID. I wake up every day and I sneeze and I go, is it COVID or is it allergies, Kelly? And then I go about my day. Like, I'm living a very different existence, and I'm not really here to make myself feel bad, because I don't have the privileged existence to go to the mountains and meditate away COVID-19. And we shouldn't put that on ourselves either. We should be really real and turn off Instagram and, you know, put on a comedy and get real about our existence and try micro goals versus some big life change.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you're right. It's right now exposing inauthenticity, I would imagine, yes. Right? Because that's not life, you know, for most people, it is not life.
Right. And it's not theirs either. And I think some of it's exposing that too. Is I think there's like a watershed moment happening in our culture all over the place of people having to be real and doing the work and personal development. And those who are doing the work are doing okay, you know, to good. And those who aren't are just crumbling around us. You know, you see these videos of people imploding on themselves for a simple thing, like, I don't want to wear a mask or whatever, right? And it's a lot of it's this lack of honesty and personal development. And it's just, people just can't tolerate that anymore, because real things are happening and we just, our tolerance for nonsense is at an all-time low.
Do you think that as America and hopefully the rest of the world moves more towards racial equality and understanding the disparity between the experiences of white versus black or, you know, whatever sort of intersection you want to focus on, that there will be greater understanding about mental health issues such as burnout? And do you think that, or are you hopeful that long term it will have a positive effect that will allow work like yours to be even more impactful because there's a greater understanding.
I mean, I hope so. It's, you know, ultimately people, this kind of work is long term work. And most people are into short term fixes, right? You can sell people on, you know, get buff in 30 days or get a bikini body in 30 days quicker than you can sell them on retrain your body on, you know, how to live or gut health or whatever. Those things people are less invested in because that requires much more work and it's long-term benefit. You may not look good in 30 days. And so I see social issues the same way as, you know, people get caught up in these moments and you kind of hope they'll understand that they're the long-term solution takes effort and consistency. And instead it's like, well, we'll get rid of Aunt Jemima on a pancake box and, you know, we'll re-edit Gone with the Wind. And I'm like, oh, okay. And you hope people don't hyper-focus on that and feel like we've done it. Like,
yeah, that's not the fix, right?
Racism. Scarlett O'Hara is no longer got slaves in a movie about slavery. I mean, it's like you really hope that isn't it because people really get, they really want a quick fix for that. And so burnout isn't, it can be restored quickly, but the tools to restore it are thoughtful things you have to keep working at. They're life skills that you have to put into place that you'll be working on for the rest of your days. And so there is no like 30 days recipe to like, you'll just snap your fingers and you won't be burned out anymore ever. And so you really hope with this movement that it shifts people to understanding the long-term consequences of racial inequality, what that has led to, and that to fix it takes equal amount of energy and care, just like burnout, right? And just like mental health in general. And you hope that people are in a space to want to do the work. And I think some people are. I was just wondering if like the collective will of America.
Is it enough people?
Right. If it'll just be like, but we changed that pancake box though. Let's go home, everybody.
Yeah, very good point. So when you work with businesses, do you set it up from the start that it's a long-term process?
Yeah, I mean, how many businesses want to hear that? I do set it up from the start that it should be. Whether they listen to that is a whole other story, you know? But just like all things, people want a profit kind of model. Like, tell me how this is going to make me money in this amount of time. And you can show them the return on investment, but you can also show them how quickly it will, you know, die off and you will be back where you started if you don't do the work. But I also have it structured now that I try not to, especially when I'm working with an organization, I don't stay long. Because one of the things you realize quickly is if you stay long, you see all the work undone. So most people have not gotten to the place yet where they are realizing. Some places have. Google, some other places that are learning what corporate culture, what makes corporate culture work. Netflix actually does a really good job of creating foundationally in their work day. They build in great productivity models that encourage self-care and mindfulness and usually don't promote burnout. Like it's really, it gets harder to burn out at those places.
Do you ever do any work with entrepreneurs, like new businesses, small businesses?
I have some people now, like it's shifting now because there's this whole boom of people who are now like me trying to do side hustles and trying to do, and that's a high burnout field too, because everybody wants to do a business and most new businesses, they burn out really quickly. So people now are being attracted to that. And I certainly am open to working with anybody because I feel like that is, people are investing a ton of money in like the mechanics of making their business work, which they should, but they're not understanding the foundational concept of their business. So they're like killing themselves to get their business off the ground in the first year and then unable to do anything with the business, right? Because they can't get out of bed because they foundationally not built it properly, if that makes sense.
No, totally. I mean, you know, even I, you know, when we're working on our clothing company, sometimes it's like, it's midnight and you're like, I should go to bed, but you're like, I need to reply to one more comment on Instagram, or I need to do, you know, one more email. And it's, you can get completely wrapped up in it. And and not realize that sometimes you can leave it till tomorrow and it'll be better. Or like, that's, you know, a lame example, but like, it's very easy to get overwhelmed with what you feel you need to do. And then, you know, it, I would imagine it's better to run at 90% capacity for a shorter period than 50% capacity for a longer period, right? I'm guessing, but that seems to make sense to me.
Absolutely. And as I started now, I'm actually, that's what I'm working on in my fall course, is I'm like restructuring some of the things, the concepts, and bringing in like time management and pairing it with authenticity and things like that for people, because I'm realizing that people are still getting stuck on like the tangibles of like, I need to do an extra thing. And I'm like, you don't though, turn it off. Like, just shut the computer down, because it really doesn't make a difference long-term, even like quantitatively, it doesn't make a difference. That one comment you answered doesn't increase your profit margin. So it's like, it will wait till tomorrow, and being authentic and being present and consistent is what matters. So the less you're able to do that, because you're running out of gas in the tank and you're just not showing up by the end of the week, right? Because you're like, I'm a zombie, but I'm on live. I'm here for you guys with dead eyes, you know, female empowerment, you know what I mean? Like, the less that's present, that's what's driving down profits. And there's people who just grind and make it, but then they can't do it for two. It's not, they can't replicate it because they have nothing left to give. And that's not sustainable. I mean, you want to be in the business for a long term. So
yeah. And I think also, you know, to just circle back quickly to the social media conversation, that there's a real misconception about overnight success, and that, you know, it, you're running your own show here. It takes years to reach a level, like whatever you think it is, double it. You know what I mean? Like, at least.
So many lies. That should be its own. I hope you're doing a podcast on that. So many lies they tell you. They tell you 60 days, you'll get, you know, this many followers. No, it does not work. And then even people who do that, it doesn't turn into profit. Like, the whole social media following and success and all of that is very different than business. And it's almost like, oh, well, you can have 400 followers and make a ton of money. You could have 400,000 followers and make $10. And it's all about like the know, like, trust factor is a real thing. People getting to know you and buying into what you sell and liking you. And that's something you can't rush. You can't manufacture, and isn't going to be dependent on if you like another comment or if you stay up 1 minute extra or not. Like, that's just going to be instilled, because once people like it, they don't care. Like, that's just it. They just, it's like a light bulb. Like, it's clicked and it's like, I'm in, I love this person, I'm down. And it's irrelevant, the rest of it. And that's what we mistake. We think there's like a formula that they're going to hook, and it takes time to hit that flash point where it's like the tipping point where it's like, there, I like you. But part of it's all authenticity and just being true to yourself and true to what you're putting out to the audience. And that takes time.
I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they were talking about selling on Instagram, and they were saying, they gave an example of, they didn't name the account, but they said it was an account that had 1 million followers. And this person, I think it was a woman, created a sweatshirt to sell to her audience, 1 million followers, and she sold 12. You know what I mean? So you're right. You can have a gazillion people, but if they're not really tied into what your product or message is, it's never going to go anywhere. And you can kill yourself trying to get that blue check mark on your profile, and you've put a lot of effort and time into the wrong energies of your business. And then...
Right, not to cut you off. And it's counter to the messaging. Like, there's nothing empowering about running after a blue check, which is not what you're saying. But I'm just saying, like, if you were to do that, if that was, like, your whole goal of existence, that is counter to your messaging. And that's the part people don't get. Like, I don't even remember, know all the people I follow. I don't know all the people I follow. But I do know some of them. And I do know, like, I like you, and I like what you and your partner have built. And it doesn't matter. I don't know how many comments you're liking. I have no idea. One, I'm too busy. And your target audience, like, your people are busy. They're not, like, sitting there going, I wonder what Marcus is doing right now on the gram. Did he like my comment? Like, they're going about their lives. They do have a care, like they do care about content, but not micromanaging how you respond to it. And that's the way it is. Like, you're going to like certain things, and if they don't grab you, you never unlike it. Like, I'll never unfollow someone unless they offend me. Yeah. But they'll be in the content queue, unrecognizable. I won't buy from them. But then people I connect with, like you, it's like, oh, yeah, I really like them. And I'll stay liking them no matter what, and it won't matter how many their followers are. I don't know what your follower count is. It doesn't matter. Because, again, you've hit the no, like, trust. And I think that's the part people get wrong, is they make these assumptions about what people's thought processes are on certain things. They have a million followers because I just didn't bother to unfollow them, because, like, why bother? They didn't make an impression one way or the other.
That's right.
The pretty picture, but I'm not going to buy. Like, it didn't register.
We would totally need to readjust expectations, right?
Yes.
And like, we've been doing this for about a year now, a little under a year. And yeah, it's been an eye opener, right? Like, you come out of the gates thinking you're gonna sell $1 million in your first year, and that is not what happens.
You're not a multimillionaire?
No, I surprisingly not yet.
Yeah, not here either. Unfortunately, this is my chance to announce my multimillion-dollar Burn Bright platform. No, that did not happen either. It takes time. It really does, and I think we have been conditioned. It just is a culture to be like, it's gonna happen right away, and it just doesn't. For 99% of the world, it's a long term.
For sure, and you got to do it. I think you have to do it because you love it. I mean, we love doing what we're doing. A big part of what I really love about it is this: like, I found you, right? And your story is amazing, and I love what you're doing, and the other women that we featured on our site are the same thing. And so I get so, that's selfish, but I get so much value personally out of that. And I'm learning, like, as a man, I'm learning so much about these conversations. So I love it. So if it takes 10 years to get to a point where, you know, it's whatever from a goal standpoint, then I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I think, and that has to be the attitude. Otherwise, you'll be folded up, right? Because if you come out of the game, like, it's got to be this much as a financial measure, you're just, I'm out in 6 months, right? And that's the same thing for me. It's not a financial measure. It is, I love what I do. I love the mission of the company. I love would be doing it, you know, regardless, because I love having conversations with you. I love the people I've met, like you and others, like, that's what brings me to this, and that's what gives me joy to be doing this, because otherwise I would be doing something else, right? I don't really want to do things anymore just for a paycheck. I've gotten beyond that. So, I mean, paychecks are nice, but it's not the only reason to be doing it. So, like you said, like, yeah, a dollar would be nice, but it's not the driving point. And so that is key. You won't stay in this if that's the only reason why you're doing it.
Do you think that if you love what you do, that can help stave off burnout or crashing or whatever else?
People who love what they do, they get tired, they don't get burned out.
Well, that must be a big distinction, right? Like, that's a big distinction.
Yeah, because you're authentic. It's authentically who you are. It's what you want to do. It's, you know, I get tired doing this for sure. Like, you can't do anything. You have limited energy. But I don't get burned out. I don't get exhausted where I can't do it anymore. I get energized and excited, and I'm like, I gotta go to bed.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, that's enough.
You have that where it's like 11, and you're like, oh, okay, I'm tired, I'm gonna go to bed. And then you have a thought just as you're about to get into bed, and all of a sudden you're like, bing, you're wide awake again.
Yes, and I'm like, let me write that down. I'm like, no, really, go to bed. That happens, but I don't get burned out. I get burned out when I don't love, and most people will tell you that. They get burned out when they're doing something they don't love.
Yeah.
It doesn't bring them joy, or they've lost the joy of what they do.
So what's next for Kelly and Burn Bright?
Making $1 million and taking over Instagram. No.
In 6 months.
In two. Oh, I'm going to show you, Mark. The right way. No. What's next for me is I have my own podcast. It's the Burn Bright podcast. And I started my own group on Facebook. It's called Banishing Burnout, Self-Care for the Selfless Professional. And it is all about the same things, principles I've talked about, helping people. It's a community, because I do believe in community and women and safe spaces for them to kind of explore self-care and mindfulness and all those things. And so that's what I'm focused on. And the course is coming out later this fall, which is to help people marry practical self-care with burnout skills and time management and all the things that we talked about. So that's what's next on the horizon for me.
Awesome. Well, that's all I got.
More than enough. We had fun today.
Yeah, this was super fun. We're definitely going to come back to your story at some point. I'm not going to let you off the hook for that
one. So good. Like, I don't want to like overhype it, but it's really good. Like, it's like a whole story and a tale. It involves theft. I mean, I'm building it all up. It's really good.
We're going to come back to that for sure.
It's really good.
Well, thank you very much for doing this, Kelly. I appreciate you taking, you know, over an hour now of your time on a Saturday morning. This has been awesome. Thank you very much.
It was so fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll put links to all your stuff in the show notes for anybody that would like to learn more. And once we put it out, it'll probably be a couple of weeks from now when we get it edited and put together. But I'll make sure you'll know, because I'll start tagging you in social posts as we promote it. So stay tuned. It's coming soon.
Cool. And I'll promote it too as well on all of my stuff.
Awesome. Thank you very much. You have a great day. And remember, it's just allergies, not COVID.
Every day. That's my affirmation.
I love it. Have a great day, Kelly. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.